From the KLYT broadcast studio, this is ABQ Connect. Your input on today's topic is important to us. Join in the conversation by calling 505-338-5790 or text 505-585-LIVE. ABQ Connect.
Thank you for joining us on ABQ Connect. I'm with my good friend Steve McKee. He is the co-founder of McKee Wallwork and Company Advertising. He's written two books, When Growth Stalls, How It Happens, When You're Stuck, and What to Do About It, and Power Branding, Leveraging the Success of the World's Best Brands, and a third book on its way called Turns.
Turns, where business is won and lost.
Where business is won and lost.
Yeah.
I know about the lost part.
Me too.
You didn't consult with me on that, though.
No, I didn't want to hurt your feelings.
Hey, Steve, we can joke around a lot, and you've been very serious about learning how to craft messages. Mm. You know about advertising. You know about marketing. You're very much a market research person. You've looked at politics at every level, especially in our fine state. So we're going to have a discussion today. I'm going to ask you a series of questions that I'm hoping you're going to tie together for us. But maybe I should just say this. Our state is a group of very diverse individuals, and I'm going to call our state a community. And of course, community can be defined as a group of diverse people living in the same place with characteristics in common that bind them together in fellowship as a result of sharing common attitudes, goals, and interests. Now, you might be sitting there going, I'm not sure how many common attitudes, goals, and interests I share with the other political party, whichever that may be. But here's the truth. We need to work together. We need to be together. And we do have a community. And politics should not define us. So I want to make sure that we start this whole thing. We're going to talk about turns in a minute. But mm-hmm. I want to lay the groundwork for what is politics? What does it even mean? Politics.
Well, I'm not I think it comes from the Greek. I'm not a Greek historian, but right. Politics, basically, at its most basic form, is how we decide to live together. It's how we agree that the rules are going to be. You know, just how do we decide who's going to do what? That's really all. It's very basic minimum. It is. So if you're stranded on a desert island alone, there's no politics. As soon as there's a second person there, there's politics.
Yes. And you've said to us in past shows that the whole reason you believe politics is important for everyone to get involved with is because they're already involved.
They are. Yeah, we all are by definition. It's just, are you going to sleep through it or are you going to walk through it?
Yeah. I love that. Are you going to sleep through it or walk through it? And Steve, we have a state. You care about our state a lot. I know that you have several of your children that have moved out of state, as have I. Mm. Children that we raised together, right? Mm-hmm. And that makes me sad. And the thing that makes me more sad than anything is they look at New Mexico now, and they are thankful for their upbringing and all the things they had here. But in some sense, they're afraid to ever come back here. Now, not to visit, but
yeah.
It's almost like they wouldn't consider coming back because it's like, Dad, I'm afraid I couldn't get a job there. Dad, I'm afraid my children would be in trouble in the schools if I came back there. I mean, there's a list of stuff.
There is. And with my kids, it's partly a function of opportunity. They just know how limited the opportunities are here. And they're torn because they love it here. They want to be with their family. But they got to live a life. You know, they got to build a life. When I was young, Denise and I, we left shortly after college because I lost my job here, and we moved away, and we fought our way back. We mm-hmm. determined to come back for all the right reasons, but it was scary, and I didn't know what the future held. I thought I might have to change careers, you know, mm-hmm. didn't know what our income was going to be like. And so that's, unfortunately, that was 35 years ago, and nothing has changed. In fact, in some ways it's gotten worse. We have somebody we know, I don't want to exaggerate, probably once a quarter say, we're out of here, going to Texas, going to Arizona, I'm giving up, done. And these are people who have some wealth and have, or they might be job creators. They have, mm-hmm. they have some wherewithal. They've raised their kids. They're tired. I was at a coffee shop the other day, ran into a former client who, I've always gotten along very well with. I hadn't seen her in years. And we were catching up, and she was saying goodbye because she said, day after tomorrow, we're leaving. We're going to Arizona. And I said, why? And she said, I'm just done, which is very sad to me. Very sad. I'm not giving up yet.
I want our audience to know a little bit more about you. Even though you've contributed to this program quite frequently, you're a Christian man, raised your children in the church, very involved in church. The thing that's really cool is you guys have been part of a home fellowship with some couples for a really long time.
36 years.
And that is so special. And I know all those couples.
Yeah.
And I know all their kids. And man, that is such a testimony because you guys have stood together and been together and gone through highs and lows and all of that good stuff. So let's shift back now to, I just talked about the books you've written. Mm. And you're trying to help people that are in business. And again, you have an advertising marketing background and you do a lot of study. Tell us about your book, Turns. Not released yet.
Not released yet.
But there's going to be some cool expectations about it.
Turns, it was the most fun I've had. I love writing. It started as a book about corporate turnarounds because that's what my company does effectively for a living. And I just thought that was a little too narrowly focused and uninteresting. And so I pulled the telescope back to turns themselves. And we're talking about turns. When people say, what's your book called? And I say turns, they look at me like, turns? You mean like turns? Yeah, it's about turns. And so I did several months of research and looked at turns in the physical world. So everything from the turn of the Earth's orbit around the sun to the turn of a ballerina on her toes to sports turns to... So physical turns in the physical world, cars turning on a track. I looked at turns in history, you know, turning points in history, turns in politics, turns in war. I mentioned turns in sports, turns in religion. The Reformation carries a significant role in this book, oddly enough. And I thought, okay, I'm getting too far afield here. But what I realized in looking at turns, physical, historical, metaphorical, and otherwise, by the way, if you look up turns in the dictionary, there's more than 100 definitions.
Is that right?
Yeah. And turn idioms. We use turn idioms all the time, every day. We don't even realize it. But what I did come to understand was there are 6 characteristics of every turn. No matter what kind of turn it is, 6 characteristics. I thought, okay, I'm onto something here. And so there's a chapter in the book about each of the characteristics, and I weave in all the different examples, and there's an introductory chapter and a concluding chapter. But what makes it so interesting to me is it is a business book. It's an advice book. And if you know anything about business books, it's kind of, you know, Jim Collins-esque. I'm not saying I can write like he can, but that sort of idea. But also sort of Malcolm Gladwell-esque, because he wrote those books, Blink and Tipping Point, about everyday things. Mm-hmm. And so we carry through the book, the Reformation. That's one of the meta turns that I cover in every chapter. One way to think about the Reformation is it was a turn that happened over a 7-year period between 1517 and 1525. Mm-hmm. Another way to think about it is it was a turn that began there about 100 years before and went to 100 years later. Another way to think about it, it's a turn that began at the resurrection of Christ and will end at the second coming. And another way to think about it is it goes all the way back to the beginning of time. It just depends on what your lens is. But there was this pivotal moment on October 31st, 1517, when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door. This just happened to be the moment that we consider the turn, even though the turn is much more than that. So fascinating stuff. A second example, which is totally far afield, is the evolution of our economy from feudalism to market capitalism. So it's like, okay, that's different. A lot of interesting turns there. A third example.
And still 6 characteristics of those turns?
Yep. The Civil War, specifically the evolution from slavery being the norm in human civilization to slavery being anathema, and how the Civil War was sort of the, at least in the United States, was sort of the equivalent of Martin Luther's nailing his 95 Theses. And so we rotated, we turned around that, but the turn is still not complete. And then, of course, I have a meta example of a company that went through a significant turnaround. And so, believe it or not, I know that sounds a little different. All these things are stitched together. I learned an immense amount writing the book. I enjoyed myself writing the book. I chuckled a couple times realizing some of these things. And I think it's just going to be a really fun read for people, but who knows?
as a business person, and I'm changing some of my questions here, but it's because I'm listening to you. In, as a business person, did you only work with people that totally thought like you?
Oh, no.
So in other words, you might have had a atheist client.
Have.
Maybe a Muslim client.
Yes.
An LDS client.
Uh-huh.
Some Christian clients, mm-hmm. but of different denominations.
Mm-hmm. Some different political parties, some different
orientations. Okay. And were you equally as successful in those relationships, helping them with their business as you were
yes.
with others?
Yes. Because we approach it humanity first.
Okay. So I have to say, does New Mexico need a turnaround?
Yes. Oh, immensely.
Steve, I've used this analogy with you before, but I think about, it's really fun to watch a Lobo basketball game. It's really fun to watch any kind of sports.
Basketball's in the book, by the way.
Oh, good. Good stuff. But I can't help but think about how quickly sometimes we fire coaches.
Yes.
Because they don't win. Well, think about how important running our state is mm-hmm. as part of the House of Representatives at the state level, state Senate, the governor's office, you name it, judges. And the truth is that the incumbents that have been there a really long time have coached us to last.
They have.
And is there some reason we're not making a change? We're not turning it around as people, as voters?
Yes. There's a lot of reasons that I haven't entirely figured out, because if I had,
yes,
we'd be halfway to the solution. But we, in New Mexico specifically, there is a, there's a kindness, there's a respect for authority. These are the good aspects of New Mexico. There is a sense of perspective on life. Most people don't think politics are, you know, the be all and end all. And so we tend to move very slowly. And that is a detriment in business. I think everybody would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
From a lifestyle perspective, it's a positive thing. That's why we like to live here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of two sides of the same coin. But yeah, we haven't, I don't think people are engaged enough. We've talked about this in the past as well, to connect certain dots. And I also think that the national environment, the degradation of our politics hasn't helped either. So it gets so emotional and personal so quickly that we can't really have a rational conversation. When I'm speaking with one of my clients about the need for a turnaround, for example, it's emotional to them. I mean, this is their business. It's their livelihood. But we can get through that. We can talk about what are the real issues and what do we need to do about them. But when it comes to our politics.
But they believe they've hired you, they're paying you to help them turn things around or to expand things they've hired you to help them turn their business in a positive direction or to keep them going in a positive direction. So you have common goals in mind. Mm-hmm. But don't we really have common goals in mind politically too?
No.
No.
I've become convinced we don't. Most of us do, us being the people, the voters. We really do. Those who are in power, and I don't want to become a cynic or a conspiracy theorist, so don't get me wrong, but those who are in power, one of the things I've learned is that not everybody in Santa Fe, for example, is trying to solve the same problems. There are people, and this is true of Washington as well, for whom their position is at the top. Getting reelected is at the top. Raising campaign donations is at the top. Or even their vision for our state is different. And so one of the mystifying things is we tend to think that we're all trying to solve the same problem. We just have different strategies. I think to a large extent that's true, but not entirely true. And that's why it's up to us as individual voters to learn and discern and vote accordingly. If we did, we could change it.
You looked at Colorado, and I don't know the timeline on this, but Colorado could have been considered a red state.
It very much was.
At one time, and is now considered to be a blue state.
Very much.
I think you've told, and I don't know how, I'm going to paraphrase, obviously, the things, but I want you to know that I do listen to you. So you've talked to us about people that have a liberal orientation, but I think they have common goals to me in that they want to raise their families in a safe place and they want their kids to have opportunities, et cetera. And they move out of California and they come to Colorado. And yet so many people have done that. Colorado turns blue and then they have all the same problems that they left California for. That seems paradoxical to me.
Yeah, it's because you're sort of connecting the dots at a 30,000 foot level. People, individuals don't necessarily, they left California, for example, because of the problems in California, but that doesn't mean that they have diagnosed the problems in California the same way you or I have. So, what specifically happened in Colorado is a community got together and was very well organized and very well coordinated and very well funded and did in 6 years what they had committed to do over the course of a decade. It was kind of remarkable. I still think Colorado is a red state at its core, but in terms of its political power, it's a blue state. But this is part of our problem, I think, is talking about red versus blue as if that's the game, because it's really not. I mean, the extent to which we're on a red side or a blue side kind of means we've already lost. Mm-hmm. Carl Truman is a wonderful professor, seminary professor, and he talks about the need to belong. Fascinating how we as human beings are created as social beings. We are meant to be in relationship with one another, and we have a need to belong, which is why, you know, the young generation will rebel against their parents, but then they'll dress the exact same way as all their friends, because that's what belonging means. He uses a great example, which you'll identify with, of when we're picking teams in basketball. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be picked last, and you want to be picked first, because it means you belong. So I think we all understand we have this need for belonging. We used to get that need for belonging fulfilled by family first, church, civic organizations. Alex de Tocqueville, you know, wrote Democracy in America in the early 1800s, and that's what he observed. That's what made everything work here. But as those institutions have increasingly been breaking down, the need for belonging hasn't changed, and so people are looking for belonging in different ways. By my race, by my gender, by my sexual orientation, or by my political party. And so the role of party identification, I don't even say political parties, the role of party identification in our lives has become way too dominant, far too dominant. That should be a tactical fight that we have during election season, not a continual, you know, war that we have year round. And I think the more we can realize that, the better off we'll be.
Do you remember the name of the doctor that runs the CDC? I can't remember her name off the top of my head.
Oh, Walensky.
Walensky. So she did something very unusual politically here 3 or 4 months ago. She said, we made a mistake. We should have done this and this and this. And I thought that was so refreshing. That was like, wow, that was cool. You learned from your actions. Maybe the next time there's a pandemic, things at least out of the CDC will be a little bit different. But at the same time, as I say that, I know the politicians will get involved.
And they'll pounce. And that's because of the environment we're in now. I mean, the CDC just last week voted unanimously to, you know, recommend that children's immunizations in school include the COVID vaccine. So there's still some of that. If more people said we made a mistake more often, maybe we could overcome that. I admire it, but we in this environment we tend to pounce.
We do. And I guess I should get back to you're a business owner. I know politics cannot be run as a business. It's a different animal. But there's got to be some fundamentals changed about politics in general, because I can't understand why people that are leaders, if you're a CEO of a company and your company's finishing last in your particular vertical, you're not going to lose your job. Your business is going to be out of business. So you're going to be taken out of that position so quickly by the board of directors and the other leaders. The accountability is going to remove you from that situation and hopefully change the course.
Yeah, and that's the key. We observe in our business, we work with for-profit companies and not-for-profit companies. For-profit companies, we like to say, if you only eat what you can kill, then there's real accountability, because if you're not bringing in the money, you're not-for-profits, there's less accountability. Long-term, there's still accountability, but if you don't go to work today, you're not going to lose the sale. And so that's the challenge facing nonprofits. Get into the elected official administrative arena, there's very little accountability. I mean, you can put a policy in place that is absolutely disastrous that we won't realize for 5 or 10 years, and you'll be gone or moved on to the next thing. That's part of the problem. The solution is not to hunt down and jail the people who made those decisions, because that'd be a whole other set of problems. But the solution is to give government the smallest brief you can give it. As I'm fond of saying, government should only do what only government can do.
Yes. What can they do?
Well, government, national security, right?
So they can provide infrastructure.
They can provide infrastructure, right. Locally, police. But that's all. Government should only do what only government can do. We've even seen, take infrastructure, for example. Government needs to provide it, but you don't have to have government employees laying the asphalt. Yes. And so they've privatized a lot of that. If you remember when they built the Big Eye, we rebuilt the Big Eye, that was a privatized contract with incentives in it to get done on time and under budget. And they did.
They did.
And that's a great model. Apply that model to our education system. This is a big idea that I don't think anybody's really talking about. We have made a social compact that we are going to have public financing of education. And I'm fully on board with that, that the kids from the poorer neighborhoods should have just as much money as the kids from the richer neighborhood. But that doesn't mean we need to have public delivery of education. You can separate financing from delivery. So if we approached education the way we approached the rebuilding of the Big Eye, you raise the money through the property taxes and the tax system, you allocate it fairly, but you let the private sector execute it with the proper incentives and safeguards in place, our education system would change radically. Arizona basically just did that. They're giving $7,500 per kid to the family to spend on whatever they want related to the child's education. It's going to radically change things. We will do that probably in 20 or 30 years.
But instead, what we do is we allocate millions of dollars. We started with $3 million 2 years ago or 3 years ago, COVID year. And then we've allocated $3 to $6 million every year since then to early childhood education, which I understand 90% of people that do research on education say that putting 2- and 3-year-olds or 4-year-olds in the classroom is detrimental to their education.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in that arena. I do think that that gets into a whole other issue of
yes.
where are our priorities as parents, and, about our kids. But even if you do that, I would submit that a privatized version of that education would deliver a lot better than a public delivery of that education.
So, Steve, I'm going to go back in our next segment after we take a break, and I'm going to talk to you about some of the advertising messages we've seen from all of the politicians. And the thing that they're talking about more than anything, at least in my view, is abortion. And most of them have nothing to do with legislating whether or not we can have abortion or not. And I want to talk to you about that when we come back. We're with Steve McKee. He's the founder of McKee Wallwork Advertising, McKee Wallwork and Company. He's written several books, and we'll talk a little bit more about those as well. Stay with us on ABQ Connect. We'll be right back.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect. There is still time to join the conversation by calling 505-338-5790 or text 505-585-LIVE.
We are back with Steve McKee on ABQ Connect. Steve, before the break, I mentioned that we're going to talk about, I don't really want to talk about the pros and cons of abortion. What I want to talk about is the messages that we keep hearing. So the case of Roe v. Wade, when that was passed plus 30 years ago, that was a federal mandate for abortion to be available to everyone regardless of state law.
It was, well, technically it wasn't a federal mandate. It was a Supreme Court ruling.
Okay. But it at a federal level.
At a federal level, it trumped state law.
Okay. So that was overturned.
Yes.
And now it's up to the states. Now, let's just start with the governor's race. So I've heard Mark Ronchetti say, I am personally against abortion, blah, blah, blah. I've heard Michelle Lujan Grisham say, I want women to have the right to women's health care, which that's an interesting definition. I still have lots of questions in my own heart about how anyone can think that killing a baby the day before it's supposed to be born is okay. Who's defending that helpless life? Okay, so that's my bias. I'm acknowledging that to everybody listening. But just as you started the program saying, I'm a Christian. I differ in my religious approach and what I believe in with Muslims and people in the Mormon church and atheists, et cetera. But I have clients that we work together closely. We're successful in business together. We encourage one another. We like each other. We have friendships. I mean, all of that. Mm-hmm. So I want that to transfer. I am hopeful somehow that's going to transfer to what we're talking about now, because the truth is that Mark Ronchetti came out with a message. Is this a change from what he said a week ago or 10 years ago? I don't know. But what he did say is, look, I'm not going to make this decision for anybody. I want us to vote on it as a community, as New Mexicans. Let's vote on it. But I watch the commercials that you have to watch with fascination, because that's what you do for a living. And Michelle Lujan Grisham and every other person we have congressional races underway. They're all talking about abortion. We have state house seats up for grabs. They're all talking about abortion. Abortion somehow has become the focus of this whole election. And I think there's nothing more important than a child's life, but there are a lot of other things we could be discussing that we seem to be omitting and not even having a conversation about.
Yeah. It goes back to what I was saying earlier. They're solving a different problem. The problem they are trying to solve in this moment is getting elected. And so those who think abortion is an issue that can divide and motivate people to vote are making it front and center. So there's really not a widespread effort to come together and address the issue. It's an electoral issue right now. What all the experts say is we're going to end up where Europe has ended up, at least for the foreseeable future, with a 15-week or so abortion ban, which covers 90% of all abortions or something. That's kind of where the average person settles out, which doesn't make logical sense because it's either a baby or it isn't. But it seems to be where the community consensus is. And we will probably end up there. But in the meantime, it's a political issue to get people elected or unelected.
As much as possible, I have to try to be unbiased in this question. Why are you Christians compelled to tell people about your faith?
Because Jesus said to. Jesus said it. And that's good enough for me. I mean, he commanded us to spread the gospel.
But don't people sometimes wonder why Christians are always talking about this guy Jesus? And
I hope so.
Now, okay, again, this is going back to your job in word crafting and persuasion and all of those different things. Is it our responsibility as Christians to persuade people and talk them into believing in Jesus?
Well, you're choosing your words maybe very carefully there.
Yes.
It's not my responsibility to persuade people or to talk them into it. It's my responsibility to present the gospel and to live the gospel, because only the Holy Spirit can convict somebody of sin and draw them to the Father. So it is my job to present it as winsomely as I can and as unhypocritically as I can. It's not my job to get them over the line, because I can't do that. Nobody can do that.
And people that have differing religious perspectives, is there some commonality among people that you've experienced personally? Like I know that a lot of people that are LDS are constantly out. I mean, they have missionaries that are out. You see those guys very dedicated, riding around on their bikes and different things. We've had a couple walk in the door for services at Calvary, mm-hmm. which I can tell you some funny stories about.
Yeah. Culturally, we have a lot in common with them.
Yeah.
You know, theologically, there's a
totally
pretty
different.
Thick dividing line. Yeah,
and that would be true with Muslims. And,
yeah,
and,
but it doesn't mean that they're not human beings and we can't have cordial relations with them.
And I can't help but go back to your business relations.
Yeah.
And you are getting, you're not only getting along, but you're productive and you're friends and you're accomplishing something together and you're ensuring the safety of their families and the families that work for their companies.
And in my context, in my mind, that is a part of the presentation of the gospel. Hmm. Companies don't come and hire me and say, will you tell me about Jesus? That's right. Not what they do.
Right.
Companies come to me and I say in my mind, I sure want you to know about Jesus. But here's where we got to start. We got to start with, I have to serve you well.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you have to earn the right to be heard.
Yeah. You have to earn the right. You have to earn the right to be, to have your words respected. Mm. You don't have to earn the right to say something, but for them to hear it, there has to be some respect there. I find it interesting. Paul in Acts, I'm actually in the book of Acts, now, which is, I wish somebody would make a movie about that. It would be so amazing. Yeah. A real movie. And take it slowly. You
know, yes.
Cover a few verses in it. Not a. He had his road to Damascus experience. And within a few days, like days, in Acts chapter 9, it says, Saul, his name wasn't even Paul yet, kept increasing in strength and confounding the Jews who lived at Damascus by proving that Jesus is the Christ. Proving, so I just, what blows my mind about that is here's Saul, who was a Jew of Jews, a Hebrew of Hebrews, right? Steeped in the law, a Pharisee, the whole thing. Imagine what, upon his conversion, how all that stuff just kind of clicked in his mind.
Well, and he was killing Christians.
Yeah, but all of the prophecy in the Old Testament, all of the foreshadowing of Jesus, over those first few days, his mind was had to be blown, like, I get it now. It's all coming together. And so he could go in and prove that because his earning the right to be heard was he was a Hebrew of Hebrews,
yes,
and a scholar, and they knew it, which is why when he went from city to city, they invited him into the synagogue to speak. So his version of earning the right to be heard was by his pedigree.
Mm-hmm.
My version is by my service, and all of us, it's by whatever it is.
We've talked a lot about the paradox of what people are talking about between politics and business. And why can't there be some synergies in terms of working with people and caring for people and getting things done? How important, I guess I should back up and say, we as individuals might be way over our heads with all of this, but there is something that we can do, and we could actually drive over to the voting polling place right now and do it.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that?
I think the extent to which we don't, we're being disobedient because, and I think we've spoken about this before, render unto God what is God's and unto Caesar what is Caesar's. In America, we are Caesar, all of us, because we're a country of the people, by the people, and for the people. And we are obliged. God has given us the privilege of self-government. We are obliged to exercise self-government. So the extent to which we don't vote, I believe we're being disobedient. And the extent to which we casually vote or cavalierly vote, I think we're being disobedient. That's my opinion. If we all did, we'd have a lot of things different, a lot of things the way that we think they should be, just by voting.
So when you talk about preparing to vote, what do you mean?
Not voting by your party, strictly, only. Those of us who are very involved are part of a party because we identify with it. We understand the platform, but not just reflexively because my dad was or my mom was. Not voting based on someone's race or attractiveness or TV commercials because they're just, the Federal Trade Commission will fine me or put me in jail if I lie about any of my clients' business.
Mm-hmm.
If I was a politician, I can lie with impunity. Now, that's a First Amendment issue.
That is unbelievable.
Well, but there's a lot to that. The alternative is worse. The alternative is actually worse.
Okay.
Unfortunately, politicians can lie. They can say things that are flatly not true in their ads, and they do, and that's why they do, which is why it's incumbent upon us to not trust at face value what they say. We have to look at, but it's really not very difficult. If you were to go to pick a state, pick a Senate campaign, two candidates you don't know, Republican and Democrat, go spend 60 seconds on each of their websites and you'll know who you want to vote for. Because, you know, when it gets to their websites, they have to put their policy position. You can tell.
Yes.
A 30-second commercial? So it's really, we've talked about this. It's not hard. It's not hard.
So you're not actually asking somebody to go study for hours.
No.
This is simple lookup stuff.
Simple lookup stuff. Where it gets really confusing, the bond issues are almost always labeled the opposite of what they are because they've learned that. Almost always. I don't want to make that a blanket statement. So sometimes it's a little more difficult to wade through those. But you can always find, so when there's a confusing bond issue, you can always find a commentator interpreting it on each side, and so you can read those. But for the big issues, governor, senator, house, state house, state senate, it's not hard.
I was fascinated to see Dick Niffing doing a commercial for Mark Ronchetti. I really liked what Dick had to say. He said, "You trusted me for years to give you the news." And we did, man. He's the Walter Cronkite of New Mexico. Am I wrong?
No, he is.
And Dick just, you know, told the truth. I remember watching election results with Dick Niffing for 20 years, maybe more. And he just, you know, what they do is they show a little slide of each one of the commercials that Michelle Lujan Grisham's team is saying about Mark Ronchetti, and these are false. Well, I've seen Michelle do similar kinds of things. She has a lot of law enforcement people doing those kinds of things. But there are some overriding facts. Can a candidate close the border in New Mexico?
No.
How does that happen? Because I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. Everybody I've spoken with, I've talked to people from Mexico. And when I say that, I mean Mexican voters, Hispanic voters. I've talked to whites, blacks, etc., Las Cruces, Deming area. They are overwhelmed with the number of people that are in their communities. And by the way, they don't treat people badly. They want to take care of people. They want to make sure they have food. They look at these sad situations of parents with three little kids. And they want to help them. But how?
Yeah, well, the border issue is just like the abortion issue in this regard. The governor of New Mexico does not have the authority to close the border because it's a federal responsibility. However, the governor of New Mexico has a lot of power to make it a lot more difficult for drug smugglers or traffickers to enter. So there's some nuance to the argument. But instead, we get caught up with, you know, she wants open borders. He wants, you know, he's a racist or whatever they say. Rather than saying, you know, what the truth is. Having said that, you can get a sense from their websites and about their general belief whether we should have reasonable, controlled immigration or no immigration. Some candidates might want that. Or open borders. I don't know anybody that wants totally open borders. That's sort of an accusation that gets hurled. Or
we kind of do have totally open borders.
We kind of do. Yeah, we kind of do.
I mean, I'm looking at clips every day now of literally hundreds of people walking across the river.
Yeah, this is part of our political discourse that's so awful. I don't know. I know there are people. I don't know anybody who's anti-immigration. I don't know a soul. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who are anti-illegal immigration.
Yes,
including myself. Mm-hmm. I'm all for immigration. Immigration's what made this country. But we conflate. See, the politicians conflate the issues.
Okay, I do need to say in that breath, though, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but I talked with an immigration attorney. It was a young man that I coached in basketball at Hope Christian School. Christian young man, works as an immigration attorney. He works with all the refugee camps right on the other side of a town in Texas, in Mexico. He said, "Coach Jim," he says, "here's the thing I can't understand. Why does it take someone 10 years to legally immigrate into this country?" Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, I come from a banking background. I can do an FBI background investigation on you in 15 minutes.
We could fix it we could fix it. We don't want to because we're solving a different problem. It's a wonderful political issue. And I say that in scare quotes. It's a wonderful issue for politicians to beat each other up with. We could fix it because the vast majority of America, and I've done a lot of research, the vast majority of Americans are circling right around the middle of this thing. And unlike abortion, where a compromise on 15 weeks doesn't make logical sense, you just can't, but you might accept it. A compromise on the border, you can't have no immigration, right, and you can't have open borders. Right. So the correct answer there is somewhere in the middle, but we won't do it.
We won't do it. We are with Steve McKee here on ABQ Connect, and he's got a lot of knowledge. He's an author. He's been a businessman for many years. He's a family man, raised kids. He's doing the grandpa thing now a little bit. Really kind of cool to see the recent vacation you went on to Europe. You might have to mention a few things about that. Your lovely wife, Denise, looks like she was having a blast doing that as well. We'll be back with Steve McKee for a final segment. This will be a little bit longer than our first two. We'll be back after these messages.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect. There's still time to join the conversation by calling 505-338-5790 or text 505-585-LIVE. ABQ Connect.
Steve, how long have you been married?
36 years.
And so you just took this unbelievable trip. I saw the cool pictures on Facebook. What a special time.
We had a wonderful time. We went to France. My wife has ancestry there. So we did the tourist things, but then we also went looking for ghosts. Not really ghosts. We looked at a lot of tombstones.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It was fun. Drove through the countryside. When you go to a small restaurant in a small town in the middle of France, you eat what they put in front of you. Because they don't speak English and I speak French.
That's fun. Well, I mean, I know that it just looked like you guys were really refreshed, having a special time together.
We did. We were able to go to Normandy, which was very moving. You realize when you see what happened there, that it happened the day before yesterday. I mean, this is recent history.
Yes.
And those young people, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, it's so humbling. It's just...
When you think about the courage it took to leave a boat, run up the beach with bombs, machine gun fire, and everything else, I mean, the courage it took to be on the first wave, unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
The sacrifice that was made.
It's just very humbling.
And the people of France were taken over by the Nazis at that time. So we came right in when they were at their worst and helped them out. So, no, that's an amazing thing for people. Do Americans actually realize from whence we came? Do we even think about what our forefathers did in the designing of our country, why things are the way they are, why we have the three branches of government, et cetera? Do we even have a concept of why that exists?
Nope, because we don't teach civics anymore. And it's really not taught in our social studies classes. Even when we were kids, we didn't get much of that. We got a lot of it compared to today, but we aren't taught civics. Now, if for some reason we were to privatize the delivery of education, we could teach kids civics. And I think on Constitution Day, which is in late September every year, high school kids certainly should read the Constitution. It's not that long. Just read it.
Yeah.
Why not? You'd learn a lot.
Sure.
To say nothing of our founding fathers. I'm very concerned because the Bill of Rights, which is First Amendment, Second Amendment, so forth, James Madison actually thought that it wasn't necessary in the Constitution, but he was talked into it. Time has proven that it has been very necessary, and even it is under attack now. It's being threatened that freedom of speech, maybe that's not such a good thing. And that's terrifying to me. We know the freedom of religion. Those are terrifying things, which is why this is so, so very important. We need to teach our kids the reasons why these things are in place. You know, it's all Chesterton's fence, right? G.K. Chesterton, paraphrasing, said, if you're walking through the forest and you come across a fence, before you tear it down, you should probably ask why it's there.
Yeah.
You know?
Maybe a cliff on the other side.
Yeah, or who knows? So if more people understood why our nation was formed the way it was, I think people would be more concerned with protecting it. But we don't teach history.
Yeah, it's sad. I recommend this to anybody. I went to a little school called Hillsdale College, and I took their Constitution 101 class. It's about 10 segments. They give you notes.
It's outline. Free, right?
It's free.
And it's online.
It's online. Unbelievable. I mean, the things that I learned, like for example, it's fascinating to me to know that George Washington was so incredibly popular that he could have been the king of America. Mm-hmm. He said, "Nope, I want there to be term limits. I want there to be a peaceful transition of power." And by the way, that had never been done before.
That's why he's arguably the greatest man American has ever lived.
But
he and Abraham Lincoln. Right?
But the cancel culture people will say, "Oh, well, you know, he didn't treat slaves right, or he didn't do."
And he did. He did own slave, and that's a problem. But you know, we can't. He who's without sin cast the first stone.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think about Thomas Jefferson, who was also a slave owner. But he pens the Declaration of Independence,
which set in motion, and this is in turns, by the way. I know I can't make a commercial plug, but this is in turns.
I love it.
He set in motion the destruction of slavery in America because, believe it or not, in the Declaration of Independence, there was, or was it the Constitution? I'm getting mixed up. There was in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson condemned slavery.
Yes.
And two states made him take it out, Georgia and South Carolina. So Jefferson, his intent, he was a slave owner.
By the way, he's a slave owner when he writes that.
He's a slave owner. His intent, he condemned the practice. And in the Constitution was passed with a 20-year sunset on the slave trade. Now, it should have been eliminated immediately. But in the Constitution, they sunsetted the slave trade 20 years hence. The day that came to pass, the slave trade was over. Actually, in the Constitution, they said, you can't end the slave trade for 20 years. But when that 20 years had passed, the slave trade was ended. And then we know what happened. There was a bunch of internal machinations in our nation for 30 years. But we ended up losing 750,000 Americans, ending the evil of slavery. That's a glorious star on the blemish that is America's original sin.
There was a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Assembly at Virginia 8 years after he wrote the Declaration of Independence. I'm going to paraphrase, but he says three things about slavery. Again, still a slave owner. He says there's three reasons that slavery is bad for America. The first one is because slaves and their children will learn to hate this country. Number two, he says slave owners are not just arrogant people that lord over others and think they're better than them or over slaves, but they do that over everybody. They're haughty. They're conceited. They, et cetera. But here's the most important reason, he said. And Thomas Jefferson was one of these people that thought if he lost his slaves, he would go out of business. He respected them. Well, I know blacks in America sometimes think that Thomas Jefferson was disrespecting them or whatever because he was a slave owner, and that may be true. But at the same time, what black Americans need to understand is that people that were slave owners were not only aware of the physical strength and the prowess of slaves, but they were also highly cognizant of their intellectual abilities, and they were terrified that there would be a slave revolt. Thomas Jefferson said in this letter to the Assembly at Virginia, he said, if there were to be a war between the slaves and slave owners, God would not be on the side of the slave owners.
And there did end up being a war. And, you know, Lincoln said that, and maybe it's until we spill the blood of enough people that we've spilled over those years. I mean, it's a terrible blemish upon America, but it's also true that first the United Kingdom and then America are the first civilizations in world history to eliminate slavery. It still exists today.
Yes.
So this kind of gets back to our issue. I can't even imagine what that was like, but we can either condemn ourselves for having done it or be optimistic because we overcame it. We still have issues. Let's overcome them. You know, let's come together. Let's make progress rather than poking the finger at one another.
So we talked about this small group that you've been part of for over 36 years. When Steve McKee did something wrong, did you ever have anybody come to you and say, Steve, you're blowing it?
On the spot.
And so you didn't react negatively to that.
Because we were in relationship. And this is really important, we presumed each other's goodwill. We presumed. So even if Denise and I have a saying when we're arguing, which is extremely rare, don't listen to what I'm saying. Listen to what I'm trying to say. Because I'll put my foot in my mouth regularly all the time. But with that little statement, it's a signal to her to say, okay, he's probably going to say something stupid right now. But if I try to listen to his heart, maybe we can get through it. And that's it. We if you presume the other person's goodwill, even if they do something that offends you, you can scratch your head and say, okay, that didn't work, but I'm assuming you of goodwill, so let's work through it. We don't do that. That we don't do these days, especially in our politics. We do not presume each other's goodwill. And I have to say, with the exception of the peak angry politicians, I think both everybody on both sides of the aisle, generally speaking, are people of goodwill.
Steve, leave our listeners with something that's not overwhelming. Most of what we're talking about, there's so many things coming at us, so many different messages. It's difficult for us to know where to turn, what to do. What should we do?
At the risk of promoting my book, one of the principles of turns is that you can always initiate a new turn. And so we come to crossroads in our lives. Sometimes they're forced upon us and we're forced to turn. Sometimes they're opportunities and we have the option to turn. Sometimes they're positive turns. Sometimes they're negative turns. What's true in every case, though, is you can always initiate a new turn. All of us can. Each of us can. And so if there's anything optimistic I have to say is you have agency as an individual. And in your world, you can't change the world maybe, but you can change your world. So if there's something you don't like, initiate a turn.
Steve, thank you for joining us today on ABQ Connect. I appreciate you so much. Always blessed. Don't forget to join Steve Ryman regularly here on ABQ Connect.
Connect is a production of KLYT. The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KLYT.